Welcome to Authors of the Pacific Northwest, where we connect Pacific Northwest authors with new listeners and provide advice for aspiring authors on the business of writing. I'm your host, Vicki J. Carter. So hi there, listeners. Welcome back to the podcast. And today I have Peter Gibb, who I'm very excited to have on the podcast. So Peter, say hi to our listeners.
Hello, listeners. Hi.
So Peter is going to have a really great information for us on a topic we haven't really talked about yet. So I was looking forward to having him on the podcast. But first, Peter, tell us what state you live in, and also if you still have a day job, what is that? If not, if you're just solely doing the authoring thing, that's cool too.
Okay. I live in Oregon, Southern Oregon, actually the town of Ashland, quite near the California border. I've lived here for the last 14 years after living in the San Francisco Bay Area for many years and working pretty much full-time in Europe for quite a while. And do I have a day job? I have a day job. My day job is writing.
Yay!
many years of having lots of other day jobs that gave me time to write. I am basically a full-time writer right now.
Oh, congratulations. That's what I'm aspiring to eventually in the future.
Years to get there.
Oh, I know. That's kind of the process of all of this and the podcast was because I knew that eventually I will get there, but I needed to find out more information about all of the process. And so that's
sure.
So fantastic. Yeah. Okay. So I'm curious, you worked in Europe. Can you share with us a little bit about what you did in Europe? That sounds interesting.
Sure. Well, I actually worked in Europe several times, but the most recent one was a partner in an organizational consulting company out of San Francisco. And so I opened up a division of our company in Europe. That's what I went over there to do. I lived in Dublin, Ireland for a year. I've also lived in Germany and other places around. But I brought my family over there, and my daughter went to school in Ireland. And then my wife and my daughter came back, and I sort of commuted for about 4 years from San Francisco to Europe.
Oh my goodness.
That I recommend for anybody.
No, it takes a lot of energy in a relationship to have that kind of distance between.
it's exhausting, too.
Yeah.
But it's what I had to do, and I'm glad I did it, but it was. I wouldn't recommend it as path.
Yeah. I lived that life for about 11 years. My husband was in music and we raised our kids when they were younger with him being on the road full time and traveling all the world. And we got to go to Europe and Africa because of his music. So I also been to Ireland. Loved Ireland.
Yeah.
Would have lived there. I mean, I was considering how to figure out how we could have moved there. It was fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great country. It's a wonderful country.
Yeah. It is. So right up front, I always ask authors what you would like to share with your new readers. So people that are coming to this podcast don't know anything about you. What's something unique you'd like to share with them right up front?
Okay. For years, I wanted to be a writer, and I thought that writing meant fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I really dismissed the subject of memoir. It was, to me, in my mind, it wasn't that creative, was a little bit too much navel-gazing, that kind of thing. And it wasn't until I started doing it that I realized how wrong I had been. So the message I would like to give to your readers, if you have your listeners, if you've never thought about writing a memoir, think about it, because it is an incredible, it's a life-changing experience, and so much to learn, so creative. And for me, it's been one of the most exciting journeys I've ever taken in my life. So I recommend it highly.
Yay, I'm super excited because that's one reason why I was excited to have you on the podcast is because I go lump memoirs in my creative genres, what I call the creative genres, the fiction, and I even add history a little bit into creative genres, but fiction and children's writing. And so I was really excited because I'm really only focusing on creative writing, creative author writing, not necessarily spiritual writing or things like that. So I'm really excited for us to go a little deeper in that later on the podcast about the difference between memoir writing and fictional writing, or if there is a difference. So we'll get there.
Okay.
when did you discover you were an author? Like, when was that aha moment that you're like, I'm going to do this?
Well, I guess I need to make a distinction between when I discovered that I wanted to be an author, and when I sort of became an author, and then when I could acknowledge that I was an author. Those are three different stages,
aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. They were separated by decades in my life. I mean, I think I knew from high school, authors were my heroes. Mm-hmm. So I had a yearning to write. But it wasn't legitimized in my mind or in my family or my school or anything like that. And so even though it was a fun fantasy, but it wasn't much more than that. Then for years, as I was raising a family and working full time, I tried to write, but, I was not successful. I made a few attempts. I published some professional stuff, but it wasn't really what I wanted to do. And that was for decades. And then when I sort of retired from my consulting career and moved to Ashland, Oregon, and I knew right away that I was just so hungry to write. I just had to do it. And I began by writing children's books. I wrote several children's books. I wrote two novels, both of which are tucked away in a place that no one will ever see them.
I have a couple of those.
Yes, I wrote them, and they were great learning for me. So then I think that was the middle period of where I thought, okay, I'm going to try this, but I'm not really an author yet, mm-hmm. And I think when I became a real author and could really state that I was when I committed myself seriously on a full-time basis, working every day, and began writing a memoir, which felt like more like me, even though I love writing the novels was a fabulous experience, and I learned an enormous amount from it. But I think it was when I began to write the memoir that I felt, I just felt that grace that comes from knowing you're in the right place at the right time doing the right thing.
Absolutely. I love that you break down the three stages, because I don't know if readers often realize that authors do go through specific stages before they actually get to publication. Whatever form of publication they do, there's a definite journey that goes along with somebody creating writing and getting it to the place where others can read it and it be published. And some of us don't ever get there. I know I've stopped and started so many times.
Yes. Yeah. I've never thought of those three stages until just now, to tell you the honest truth. But you know, prompted by your question, it does seem to me that I did go through that. And I would like to legitimize that maybe for some people, you never will be or don't even want to be published. Mm-hmm. And you can be an author without being published. Those are, I don't think you have to be published to be an author. It's nice. I mean, I'm very glad to be published. But I don't think that those are not mutually exclusive, I guess, is what I'd say.
I agree with that. And sometimes I interchange author and writer in the podcast or when I'm talking to people. Like for me, I've been a writer my whole life. I'm not a published author. That's my goal, is to become published. Yes. But I'm a writer, and I always have been. And my happiest stages in life is when I'm writing. Months, years that I don't write for whatever reason, I'm not a happy person. My husband will testify to this. So fantastic. So tell us what you do have published, and kind of, I know that it's a memoir. So also dovetail on that a little bit for us. Can you explain what a memoir is for those that may not know what it is and how it might be a bit different than a fiction work?
Okay. Well, let me see where to start. Okay. First of all, there's memoir and autobiography, and a lot of people confuse those two. And a lot of people do use those two terms interchangeably. I think they are quite different. An autobiography is the story of your life. I was born here, and then I had three brothers and a sister, and blah, 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 I went to school and so on. And it tends to cover in a chronological fashion the history of your life, kind of from the get-go to the current time. Mm-hmm. A memoir, on the other hand, is the story of your life, not necessarily all the facts by a long shot, but tends to be a slice of your life, either picking up on a certain theme or a certain part of your life, or a certain relationship or whatever. Could be, you know, most memoirs are focused either on the, like there are coming of age memoirs, mm-hmm. there are memoirs about your career, memoirs about perhaps a health challenge or a loss or a spiritual memoir or whatever. But they tend to focus on a particular theme. And so you pick out the scenes from your life that relate to that whatever theme. And then there may be, like in my memoir, I alternate chapters between childhood and adulthood, which is a rather unique structure. And the reason I do that is because I really was interested, one of the things I was most interested in was the relationship between what happens in childhood and how that shows up again and again in adulthood. And so you claim the past, as I put it. So a memoir is a thematic approach to a life, but not trying to lay out the whole history or the entire life at all. I think a memoir has more in common with fiction than it has different from fiction. But memoir, all of, from a writing standpoint, all of the same challenges, the structure, the prose, the developing characters, the having an interesting plot and theme, keeping your reader turning the pages, all those things that apply to fiction apply to memoir. Absolutely. I mean, 100%. Any technique that you can use in fiction, you can also use in memoir. Memoir is a story. In fact, one of the things that's hardest for people to realize is that even you, typically the narrator of a memoir, you are actually a character in the story. And even though you know yourself, of course, pretty well, I, the reader, don't know you at all.
Exactly, yeah.
The way that I get to know a character in fiction, I have to get to know you. And so a lot of assumptions that you would make, well, you must know me because you know me, I don't know you. So all of that shows up in memoir. The difference, of course, the main difference is that a memoir is based on fact, based on truth, and there is a contract between the memoirist and the reader that this is a true story. The difference, however, is that it is a subjective view of my life, mm-hmm. and of course, you know, 10 different people looking at my life have 10 different stories to tell. So it's not just a factual view, but the facts need to be true. And there's been some very famous memoirs that were not true, and that's not fair. That's unless you declare that up front, you know, that I'm going to change some facts. If not, the assumption, the reader's assumption is this is a true story.
Fantastic, absolutely fantastic. Because I think there is some need for clarification between memoirs, which I feel are very creative, and they fall into my creative genre in my mind, and biographical work, you know. So yes. Fabulous. Thank you for explaining to those of us that have it murky in our mind. And it also gives me some inspiration that there will be some memoir down in my future.
Well, I'm delighted to hear it.
So tell us the title that you have on your website, which is your memoir, and then did you self-publish that work?
Okay, so the title of my memoir, you mean, it's called King of Doubt.
Yes, which I love the title, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Well, the title was almost as hard to write as the book. It took me, I went through, I don't know how many different versions of the title, and the title does relate a lot to the theme of the book, but I can talk about later. I used a hybrid publisher. Okay. I don't know if, should I explain?
Yeah, why do you explain? Because we haven't necessarily had a hybrid publisher yet on the podcast, and it's fabulous to explain what that is. Okay. How it works.
So in my mind, publishing these days, and it's changing so fast, it's almost, you know, hard to say, but anyway, I identify three different kinds of publishers. There's the there's the typical traditional publisher, and I think most people probably know what that is, and that you could subdivide that into the big New York firms, and a lot of smaller, more independent, but they are traditional publishing. They typically pay you or don't pay you to publish your book, but they basically, if you publish the traditional publisher, they own the book, basically. Mm-hmm. They own the rights to the book and can do, you have a contract. But anyway, so that's kind of, in a nutshell, traditional publishing. On the other end of the extreme is self-publishing, where you do it yourself, your way. It's all yours, and you swim or you sink, and you put up the money for it, and you do the entire thing, in its extreme form, at least. And that has a lot of advantages to it. The main one in my mind is that you own that book. Mm-hmm. Nobody else can tell you how to publish it. I mean, in traditional publishers, a lot of the time, they'll say, look, here's what we're going to name your book.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. That's not the name I want.
Yeah.
They say, here's the cover. Well, wait a minute. That's not the cover. I don't see it that way. But it's their book. You're basically, you wrote it, but you're selling it to them. In the middle of those two extremes is, I think, an emerging model that I think is going to become more and more popular, which is called hybrid publishing. And mm-hmm. it takes a little bit from each. Mm-hmm. Most hybrid publishers, I publish with a company called Wheatmark, but there are a number of other hybrids around. Most of them, they curate, the better ones curate who they publish. So it's not, you can't just say, publish my book, because they decide what books they want to publish and others not. The main, a huge difference is that rather than them paying you, you pay them.
Okay.
You pay them a fee for publishing. And they do, depending upon what the contract is, they help you with website development, some PR type things. They insist on editing as well. Okay. Mm-hmm. Some of them will do a lot of the technical work, getting an ISBN and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. They'll advise you on titles, they'll advise you on covers, they'll advise you on format and layout. And so a lot of that stuff that if you've never been through it before, can be kind of overwhelming because you just don't know.
Yeah, and it's so, a business altogether.
yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of stuff there, and you can make some bad mistakes, not even know it until it's too late. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a really interesting model, as I say, because you own your book. Like I own my book, and I could do anything with it I want. Nobody can tell me whatever, but I didn't do it alone. I wasn't just out there by myself. So for me, it was a really good path to follow.
Fantastic. And I find it very interesting because I tend to lean towards self-publishing just because I'm a control freak. My podcast listeners will know this about me by the time we get to your interview. And also, I've also been in the music industry, so I kind of know the ropes of how a lot of the promotion. Sure. Those things kind of go and contracts can go. But the hybrid sounds so interesting to me in the sense that they will help more in this. As a self-publisher, you should still hire an editor. So you got to go find that editor. And you probably should, if you don't have a graphic design background, you probably should hire a graphic designer to help you with your website and your book covers. So you're initially doing all that anyways. It would be nice to have it all under one roof, one group of people. And that sounds very interesting to me. I'll make sure that in our show notes that at least the company you went through is listed for anybody that's interested to go and do some research on kind of what the hybrid model looks like. If you're like me, I'm still playing with the idea because I'm still writing. So I haven't produced enough the book yet to go the route of publishing.
Sure.
I love these conversations because I'm getting so much more information.
good. Well, I'm glad. Yeah. And I think each person, for some people with your experience and background in the music industry, you might know enough that you could self-publish and know what you're doing and not get into a lot of get over your head kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you don't know that,
it's still overwhelming. Don't anybody be fooled. Right. I say all the time that the business of writing really can distract us from the actual writing, the good part, the creative part of us that we get to sit down and write and create. The business of writing, the marketing, the promoting, all that can get in the way of that. And
enormously.
Yes, and it's exhausting, that part of it. I love it, but I also love writing. Not everybody's that way. So talk with us a little bit, because I did view your website, and I'll make sure that the listeners will have access to your website. You combined mindfulness and memoir writing together, and you do a lot of work with individuals on mindfulness and memoir writing. So share with us, and I think from what I read on your website, it came from the process of you writing this particular memoir, the idea, and you practice mindfulness. Can you kind of, in a short version, because I know this is a workshop for you, which I would love to attend eventually, short version for our listeners and your future readers of how those two M's, how you call it on your website, come together and how they play together.
Happy to, because I think that those two M's, memoir and mindfulness, are a wonderful couple, actually. And here's how it works to me. If most writing classes or books on writing focus on craft. And craft is, of course, very important, extremely important. But in my mind, long before you get to craft, you have the whole issue of, I think of mindfulness, mindful writing really has three aspects. It has awareness, discovery, and expression. And it starts with awareness. You can only write about what you're aware of. And most of us are half asleep half the time, or some of us, many of me, maybe three quarters asleep. But mindfulness is about waking up. And the more you wake up, the more you have to write about, the more aware you are of your own life, whether you're writing memoir or fiction or it doesn't really matter, the more you're really tuned into what it's like to be you, the more you have, the deeper you can go, the more interesting stuff you can write about. In my workshops, we start off with dealing with a little bit with awareness. And how do you develop awareness? Awareness of what's outside of you and awareness of what's inside you, because those are two totally different worlds, really. And then the second aspect of mindful writing is what I call discovery. When I started to write my book, I had no idea what it was about. I really didn't. I kind of knew what a memoir was, and my daughter had been after me for a number of years to write a memoir, because she said, you've got a lot of good stories to tell. Why don't you tell them? But I really wasn't interested. And when I started to write, and I kind of wrote a whole draft before I knew what I was writing about. And what I have kind of myself discovered is that you need to then start using your awareness, start writing, and be open to what the book is going to be about. Because often you don't know. And in fact, I think it's a good thing not to know when you start out. At least for me it was. Some people write in different ways, of course. But I love not knowing and going into that scary void and seeing what shows up. And I found that in a way, the story, it's not so much that I discovered the story as that the story discovered me. Yeah. It's what came up. And it's so exciting when that happens. And you finally, I know I began, because of that process, I began to understand myself the way that I hadn't for years and years and years. And I gained huge insights into who I am and what I care about and what my real story is. But I didn't know. I knew the facts of my life, but not the story. So the mindfulness starts with awareness, then goes to discovery. And then the third aspect is expression, which is really more the craft and the writing and all the stuff that you typically get in a writing class. But I think that at least half the battle is those first two. And if you don't look at those two, you really miss a huge amount of the joy and the depth of what you potentially could write. So yes. I bring those two things, and just to wind up this little part. So in my experience, the more mindful you are, the better writer you are. The better writer you are, the more mindful you become. So the two, it's just a positive reinforcing cycle.
Yes, awesome. And I think that's a fabulous way to explain it. I tried to articulate that in a blog that it'll be published after your podcast comes out, but I was doing an A to Z challenge for blogs. I got to the letter M, and I wrote a little bit about mindfulness, because it's something that I'm learning to practice. In my work life, it became very clear. And what I discussed on that blog was I worked with somebody that wasn't mindful, and it made me realize how much I needed to be mindful. And then I brought that into play of this whole podcast journey, and the writing journey for me has opened up this ability for me to be mindful of myself and where I'm at and what I'm doing. And my writing has become exponentially more brighter, I could say. And I'm getting so much more joy in my life. And so this is like, I love this discussion because for years I was wrapped up with raising kids, small kids, and, you know, working and going up the corporate ladder and all this. And the idea of being mindful would have thrown me over the edge. I think I would have been like, I can't take that, whatever. I'm on the move. And I think somewhere with age, it kind of settled in with me to look at what I'm doing every moment, what I'm in that moment. And then it's just amazing. So I love that you're doing workshops and you're explaining that process for authors, because I do think it's tied into our creativity so well. So, and thank you for sharing that for our listeners. It's wonderful.
It's working for you, and I know it can take you to places that will really help your writing, again, regardless of what kind of writing you're doing. Yeah. And one of the ways in which I've seen that happen, I thought when I started writing, I didn't remember much about my childhood. I thought, how can I write a memoir if I can't remember? And I have now found that various exercises that mindfulness kinds of exercises that we do really bring out memories that I had forgotten before. Or flesh them out. I may remember just a little bit, but it fleshes them out so I can really then have enough material to create a scene around.
Beautiful.
A lot around visualization and relaxation to help you get in touch with things that you might not remember just off the top of your head. So,
well, we will keep in touch on your website, because I have at least 5 other author friends around me in my local area. And we talk about, you know, our childhood memories and how we would like to access those a little better. We might all come down to one of your workshops and start working.
Come on down.
And then start writing about it, which would be the great outcome, right?
Sure.
So I just mentioned a little bit about my support group. I have quite a bit of a support group that's been developed through the podcast and through me reaching out as an author, or a budding author, I should say, that has been fabulous for me. I also discovered quite a few associations that are online. But can you share with us what support groups you've had as you have gone through this journey? And if there are any that I haven't had already listed on the podcast, I'll make sure we get websites together and I use that on your show notes so that other people can find them. Or if it was a group of authors, kind of talked with us a little bit about the support and networking for you.
Okay, well, first off, I think support and networking is incredibly important. I mean, writing is hard. There just isn't any way around it. And to go it alone, unless you really are a masochist.
Exactly.
It is enough. If you're into that, that's okay. But not me. So I've had various kinds of support over the years, ranging all the way from when I was writing my memoir, I hired an editor, a personal private editor, and that was enormously helpful. I have started myself and been involved in many critique groups over the years, and they have been very helpful and fun, and, you know, they have sort of life, and they're all different. But I was in I started writing children's books first. That was first, and I started a critique group that was just around children's books, and they were all writing children's books. So I've found that to be useful. I think taking writing classes is very helpful. Mm-hmm. You find, you know, and you get, so I now teach them, but I also take myself. I took a writing class myself just, you know, a few weeks ago, and it was great. I learned a lot. Organizations. There's an organization. I'm a member of a number of writing organizations. A couple of them that I'll mention that I think are particularly helpful. One is the National Association of Memoir Writers, which has actually published an anthology recently, and I'm proud to say that I am part of an essay that I wrote is in the anthology. It's called The Magic of Memoir.
Is
the name of the book. It's published by She Writes Press, and the organization is the National Association of Memoir Writers. I'm also a member of the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, which is a quite a large writers group, and you may know it. They they have a yearly conference and also sponsor contests.
Yeah.
Every year they have a contest, a really, really good contest. I'm also a member of the Willamette Writers, which is quite large, and they also have a yearly contest and a yearly conference. So both of those are things that I try to take in. So those are, I mean, it's not really a network, I guess, but like magazines, I read poets and writers and, what's the other one? I can't think of it. Reader's Digest, Writer's Digest, not Reader's Digest. anyway, so those are, and I think just networking, getting to know. Well, yeah, I shouldn't have left out. My family has been enormously supportive of me, but I think family. I mean, there's a lot we should say about that. I don't know, but I think you need to get. I need to get, and I think most writers need to get feedback from people beyond family and friends. There just is a limit to how far family and friends, and even if they're very good. My wife is a great reader and is has given me some really good feedback. But
Yes, I do. My husband loves my work. Actually, he'll tell you if you meet him face to face that he fell in love with me because of my writing. Because really? We separated when we first met and we were writing. There was no internet, cell phones, or texts really then. So we were writing letters back and forth. And he fell in love with me at that, with that part of it. And so he's always encouraged me to write. But he loves me. So he's not going to be as critical of me when I'm reading something to him as maybe a fellow author will say something like, oh, that plot is kind of got some holes in it. You know, things like that.
Yeah.
He won't even use the correct terminology. He'll say, oh, that's great. I love it. And you probably don't know this, but I found you through the Pacific Northwest Writers Association webpage. So, a lot of people don't realize that for me to put this podcast together, I had to go out and start looking for authors in the Pacific Northwest. And I found the Pacific Northwest Writers Association webpage and started just harassing authors. Like, hey, I'm going to do this podcast. In my professional life, I work in an higher educational institution, and I help students finish their degree, and I say I'm a professional harasser. And so I started to just employ that. And so that's why I was very grateful that you said yes to the podcast, because I loved your work too. So the organizations are fantastic. I will be putting those on the show notes for other people to find them as well, and they can find other options. Yeah, so.
It's really, really a good place. And I should mention one other one, which I'm no longer a member of, because I don't do children's books anymore, but the Society for Children's Books Writers and Illustrators, SCBWI, which is a huge organization, has an enormous conference every year.
Yeah, so I think one of my other authors mentioned that one too. That's a good one, but I'll make sure that's on the podcast notes too. So yeah, you're not doing children's books longer.
Children's or young adults or anything like that. It's really being part of that.
So, Peter, you're not doing children's work any longer, any more children's?
I'm not right now, no.
Okay. Well, you could in the future. You never know.
Yeah, I'm right. Well, I sort of have been working up older and older. I wrote some bird books and children's picture books. And then I wrote a young adult novel. Then I wrote an adult novel. And,
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the direction I'm moving.
So one other question before we lead into your reading, because my listeners get to listen to all these wonderful questions that I have, and then they get to settle in and listen to the authors read. But my one question is, what inspires you, or more importantly, what keeps you going as an author?
What keeps me going as an author? I think it's my curiosity and wanting to just learn more and more. And writing is such a great way to learn because, you know, you can be kind of fuzzy in your thinking.
Oh, but yes.
When you start to write, you got to figure out, now, what are we talking about here? You know, so I always, in fact, it brings me back to, I remember one of the first, perhaps the first writing class I ever took. And I remember the instructor saying, well, write what you know about. I said, I don't know what to write about. He said, well, write what you know about. And I said, okay, that makes sense. And I now, in my classes, I teach, write what you don't know about. Write what you're curious about. Write what you want to learn about. Because that will put you on the edge much more. If I write what I know about, it's kind of, I could sit down and write it. I don't have to think a whole lot, you know, because I've been there. I've done this. I know it. So I think the place, so it's my curiosity, it's wanting to, whatever I'm writing about, I want to find out what's the question that really interests me about this. Why do I want to write about this? What do I want to learn about this? And when I come from that place, I think my writing is much more alive and much more interesting. And the experience of writing is also more enlivening for me and more joyful for me. So I say it's my curiosity, my desire to learn, to explore, and to see how much I can make of my life. You know, and writing is a great tool for that.
Awesome! What great inspiration, and I love that jump off. I hear all the time, write what you know, write what you know. But I love the idea of write what you don't know. So I'm going to borrow that in my free writing because that's fantastic. Thank you. I'm stealing it from you. Well, just for me personally, I'm not ready to do writing workshops of any kind. So, so let's set the stage for your reading. First, share with us the title again, what you're going to be reading, and any little background information that you would like to share with the listeners to set the stage for what you're going to read. And then when you're done reading, I'm going to close us out for the podcast.
Okay. So the title of my memoir is King of Doubt. And I thought I would read the opening to that. It is the scene that I, or the chapter that I will read, takes place in Scotland, actually, where I started school. So this particular chapter, I'm about 5 years old in this chapter. The book, as I mentioned, alternates chapters between childhood and adulthood. And again, the reason for that is that I'm really looking at how scenes from childhood occur over and over again in adulthood. And also looking at another belief that I hold is that we tell ourselves a lot of stories. We all do. It's kind of how we make sense of life. And one of the problems that often happens is we come to believe our own stories. And we're not our story. We're the storyteller. We're not the story. And part of the theme of this book, King of Doubt, is that I suffered for many, many years from really debilitating self-doubt. And that's a lot of scenes that I choose show where that came from in childhood and then how that played out again and again in adulthood, down to the fact where an interview that I did on NPR, at the end of the interview, the interviewer said to me, well, this is a great book about imposter syndrome. And I never heard of imposters. I didn't know what that was. And it basically, you know, it's a psychologically known phenomena. And often a lot of very creative people suffer from it. Mm-hmm. But how it plays out is that the more successful I was, the more I doubted myself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I realized, oh my God, I'm going to be discovered. You're going to realize I don't have a clue what I'm talking about. I'm just a fake. I'm a fraud.
Yep.
You know, I can do it well enough. Maybe I can deceive you for 5 minutes or maybe an hour or maybe 5 hours or a year. But sooner or later, you're going to find out.
Mm-hmm.
So that was always in the background for me. And it's not a good place to live from.
No.
So the traces, it's really my dance with doubt and my learning how to deal with it. And then eventually realizing that I could make this my friend, not my enemy, doubt. And so that's kind of one of the driving themes of the book. So this first chapter, really, you'll see an instance in which I could have made up several stories about what happened, and I made up the one that was most self-defeating for me, and lived with that for decades. So I have to leave a little suspense here, so I won't tell you any more about what it is and then whatever. Hopefully that's set up. Again, so it takes place in Scotland. I'm 5 years old. I'm an American, but going to school in Scotland. Okay. Chapter one. Are you ready, lads? When the master's voice boomed, even the rain paused to listen. 23 lads squirmed, waiting for the start of the race. Toes twitched and eyes searched. Wee ones were these boys, but fierce as the weather that slammed in from the Atlantic, thrashing the west coast of Scotland. My lips quivered. I needed to pee. On your marks! The master's voice again. The boys squeezed tight their bottoms. 23 pairs of shoes pawed the mud, racehorses chomping at the starting gate, muscles taut. My shoelace was untied. My shorts hung low. I was no racehorse. Made in the USA from different stock than the Scots, I was the only Yank, and a scrawny one at that. Get set! 23 hearts thumped eagerly. One heart trembled. Go! And off they went, toes and feet and legs and arms, small but mighty intrepid soldiers of fortune sloshing through the mud of win or die. 23 muddied bodies, one burning heart, anxious, but not about winning. Will they like me? Was the fire that stoked that one smoldering heart. We were at campus doing school for boys in Ayr, Scotland, my first school and my first field day. I hoped there would never be another. Campus doing rose out of the mist so close to the ocean I smelled the brine from the sea each morning as my mother drove me up the winding driveway to the old stone castle that was now Campus doing school. On the field, the lads sped forward while my spindly legs quivered like stalks of beech grass in the wind. All eyes followed Harold Tweedy. Harold was the fastest boy in Scotland. Someone yelled, "Go, Harold! Go, laddie!" Harold was halfway to the finish line while I staggered about, lost amid the also-rans. The pack surged forward, and then suddenly, a gasp from the crowd. What's happened? It's Harold. Harold slipped. He righted himself. He slipped again. Now he was down in the mud, and behind him, McDougall tripped over Harold, and then Buchanan and Burns, and following them, McDonald, McBride, and Calhoun, falling all over one another, tripping in the mud, screeching like cracked bagpipes, trying to get up, tripping sideways and backwards, and slipping and sprawling and stumbling, and then Bruce and McGregor glanced over their shoulders to see, and down they went too, boys in the mud, and groans in the crowd. A father's voice sounded the national alarm. "Blimey, would you look at that little bugger on the end, the wee one, the Yank, isn't it? He's the only one still standing, and he's going to win the bloody race." Heads swiveled, eyes bored through me. I floundered, blowing about like a leaf in the wind, but somehow moving forward. Then I stumbled across a white line and stood shaking, surrounded by gray flannel pants and big umbrellas and the bug-eyed master, his hand gripping my shoulder too tight. The master steered me to a long table covered by a muddy, once-upon-a-time white tablecloth, and the prizes boxed and lined up like the houses along Wheatfield Road. Dazed as a daisy in winter, I grabbed the table for support and wiped my snotty nose and squished the warm mud in my hands. I turned, horrified, at the jumble of my classmates, a few now staggering toward the finish, but others still struggling to right themselves from the mud. Why am I here, alone with the prizes? And the question that glowed neon in every cell of my body, Will the lad like me now? Am I okay? The glob of goo in my stomach told me that I had won the race, but lost something. Something. What? Hard to say. Something more important than a race on a muddy field. The master's face was drawn and glum. He patted my head and we posed for a photo. He slipped me the prize. Well, laddie, here you go. Just like a sneaky yank. Found a dry patch of ground over yonder. You did. The prize was a box of toy soldiers. I held them tight to my chest as if these 10 figures could rescue me from shame. I didn't deserve the prize. I stared at the carnage on the field. No! I screamed, and the rain swallowed my wail. We sat around the kitchen table at dinner the night of the race. Dad smiled and clapped his hands. What a lad! You bloody well showed him. I loved my dad. Of course, I never told him. Words like love were shoved to the back shelf of the junk closet in our house, wedged between old magazines and broken pencils. What a thrilling race, Mom said. A proud day for America. I haven't seen your prize soldier, she said. Have you played with him yet? Mom was American, different. Her permanent curls bound magically together despite the Scottish gales. She held her skirt tight around her knees when we walked to the beach. The weather at that race was shocking, she said. I'm sure it's sunny and warm in Washington. I was not brought up for Scottish weather. Dad had recently moved us from Washington, D.C. to the west coast of Scotland. A retired British Navy pilot, he had opened a pilot's training school in Ayr. Mom was unsure if Ayr was the right place to bring up her children. What's so great about a kilt, she asked when I wanted to wear my kilt to bed. In America, all the boys wear pants. It was 1947. The war had been over for 2 years, but rationing was still a part of life in Scotland. 3 eggs per week for a family of 4 and 1 quart of milk. Every day, Mom tore out 2 small green tickets from our ration book. A crying shame what we put up with here, she said. I was learning my way around Ayr, where to hear the bagpipes, which of the Scottish lads were most likely to torment me, and where Mom hid the cookies. I both loved and feared Scotland, where the wind blew stronger and the rain fell harder than any other spot on earth. Head down, slicker up, feet swimming in galoshes, 2 sizes too big, I battled the wind and my classmates daily. I won the race. They have to like me now, don't they? I was getting used to the burr lads who sounded like they were talking with a mouth full of pebbles. The school uniform was scratchy blue gabardine shorts and a maroon blue striped tie, knee-high gray socks and gray wool shorts. My knees turned blue as the sea every morning. On warm days, they thawed out by 3. Behind our house, the backyard was wild and rocky and defiant, like Scotland. Before the race, I practiced there, racing Harold Tweedy around the yard, but he hopped faster than I ran. Harold was a winner. I was a loser. I hid my prize soldiers under the bed. The masters and the boys, the whole school would soon realize their mistake and come knocking at my front door, pointing fingers and jeering and demanding that I return the prize. Except that Dad found and opened the box of soldiers first. Looky here, he exclaimed. Aren't they wonderful? They'll remind you of the race. You must be so proud. Looking at the soldiers gave me nightmares. I dreamed the boys from Campus Doom were coming after me, and their eyes on fire, their bayonets fixed, like the soldiers, ready to gore me. At dinner the next night, I couldn't eat. Mom gave me an extra helping of pudding. For the fastest boy in Form 1, she said. I continued to fool a few, mostly adults. I learned to say please and thank you, and may I be excused, but not much else. My parents approved of me, and my teachers approved of me, and I approved of their approvals, never imagining that I was looping a noose around my neck that would continue to strangle me for 4 decades. I made up a story that explained it all. I won a race. My parents applauded, assuming that coming in first meant I was a winner. But can you claim victory if you win a race and lose your soul? I was a loser. I was unworthy, a fake, maybe even a cheat. Year after year, I refined my story, packing additional evidence of my nobodiness. The first time you tell yourself a story about yourself, it's just that, a story. The second time you tell the same story, it becomes a theory. And by the third time, it is morphed into the truth, incontrovertible, self-evident, and eternal. I told myself my loser story first thing in the morning and last thing at night, on the playground and at dinner, over and over, day after day, year after year, until it became me. I became the story. I became the fraud. At first, the voice of the fraud was just one of many voices inside my brain, but it was the loudest and the most persistent and drowned out all the others. I didn't realize that the fraud story I told myself was one of a thousand thoughts. I didn't realize that the fraud story, like all thoughts, was real, but not necessarily true. I didn't realize that I had signed a pact with the devil. I'd be a fraud. I'd cut away my heart if that's what it took to make others approve of me. The deal banished me from society deep into the dungeons of doubt, where the lost souls of life roam in dark catacombs, reserved for the living and the damned. Dad displayed my prized tin soldiers spread out in a row on their very own shelf on the bookcase in the living room across from the front door. Beautiful, proud, ready for action, just like you, Dad said. Now everyone who comes to the house will see them, and I'll tell them the story of how you won the race. The next day, when Mom and Dad were upstairs, I threw the soldiers into a bag. I fetched Dad's hammer from the chest in the front hallway, and I took the bag out to the front steps, and I smashed those soldiers into 100 pieces. I dug a hole in the ground and buried the pieces as deep as I could. Then I came back inside and returned the hammer to the chest in the front hallway and sat down as if nothing had happened. As soon as he came downstairs, Dad noticed. He shook his head. Where is your prize? Where are the soldiers? I didn't answer. He dropped it, and Mom never asked. As far as I know, the soldiers' remains are still buried deep in that hole under the Scottish mud. We lived in Scotland for another year. We never talked about the soldiers or the race again.
Bravo. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I am going to finish that story because absolutely brilliant. Thank you. And thank you so much for being on the podcast. I do know that my listeners are going to listen to that and they're going to go find you and get the book and definitely go do that, listeners. So thank you and appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. We hoped you loved hearing from the author as much as we did. If you did enjoy the author, make sure you find them on social media. Buy their book and write a review. Are you a published author and would like to be featured on the podcast? Visit us at our website to learn more. You can help support the production of this podcast by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Share the podcast with your friends. And most importantly, become a supporter. Supporters receive monthly bonus podcasts and a newsletter filled with tips from our authors. To find out more how to become a supporter, visit our website. And finally, I hope you always remember to enjoy the journey. Until next week, this is Vicki J. Carter saying goodbye.